If you're ready to confront your destiny, if this is the moment that you've been praying for, tune in and listen to your cosmic cheerleader, Commander Lady Athena, for cosmic pep talks, for closet Christ. The show is the voice of the Ashtar Command. The call is for you to step forward into your greatness. Be listening on Wednesday. We have an appointment with destiny.
Greetings in the supreme light of the one divine source. I'm Commander Lady Athena, and you're listening to the voice of the Ashtar Command, Cosmic Pep Talks for Closet Christs. This evening, our seminar topic is, what is your life's calling? And are you living true to it? What is your life's calling? And are you living true to it? So, if you're ready, take a deep breath and call yourself forward into the light of the Supreme Spirit that you truly are. Allow it to inhabit the fullness of your biosphere. Radiate it beyond the confines of your body and your mind and any thought concepts that you may hold about any of that. Keep expanding. Keep expanding. Take another deep breath. Expand even more. And allow yourself to be. To be expanded being, spacious awareness. Awareness that can come and go in form as the call of service or usefulness may dictate, but otherwise beyond the petty confines of personal, egoic definition. You take responsibility for your state in life, your progression, your realization. You take responsibility for moving your inner awareness to the state that you say is your calling. You say it's your calling. No one else can tell you your calling. You must discern your calling. And then somebody could perhaps give you validation or clarification on that. But it's always a direct encounter with the reality of your being. It's living true to who you are. By your definition and not another's. So close your eyes, if you will, gently, no forcing. And what do you see? Darkness, right? Darkness. Now be aware that someone is seeing the darkness. Someone is listening. And someone is seeing and aware of the darkness behind your closed eyelids. That, beloved, is the light that you are. That is the light of spirit, the Atma Jyoti, as it's called in Sanskrit. That is the light by which you see. That is the divine that's within the mind. That is the light of your true being. That is the light of divine awareness that has no definitive outline. It is omniscient, that is to say, all-knowing and all-present and all-powerful. So when Jesus in A Course of Miracles says there is nothing your holiness cannot do, that is what he's talking about. There is nothing. The Atma Jyoti, the light of your supreme beingness, cannot do. Every form of pain, grief, and sorrow arises from misidentifying yourself with your body and the contents of your mind. Every transcendental state delivers you beyond the personal limitations ascribed to the physical body and the contents of the mind. So what is your life's calling? What do you aspire to, think of all the time, and feel drawn to pursue? Or what do you know that you're here to do? Some of you from childhood, like myself, knew what you'd come in to do. Others of you may not have that sense yet. Usually because you haven't taken the time to really look and inquire and get in touch with your feelings. So what enthuses and inspires you so much that your mind returns to this major theme automatically, all the time? What is the one thing that you can never forget or lose sight of? What is the major impetus of your life, the goal to which you are striving with all you've got? That would be your life's calling. Your karmic destiny, your goal to be attained in this incarnation. You can become, if you're aware of your calling, if you spend some time contemplating where you're mainly focused in your life, that would be your goal in life. And to attain that goal, your daily habits and lifestyle need to be in harmony with what you say you want. One way to determine your life's calling is to take notes of what draws and holds sustained interest and attention. Pay attention to what you give attention to. When you give attention to something, you are giving your consent as well as your life force into that. What do you give your life force into? What do you invest into? Now, without an abiding interest in a topic, the mind will wander. Watch when your mind wanders because you're really not into whatever it is you're doing. You're not into it if your mind is wandering. When you really, really are interested in something, all the distractions in the world will not pull your attention away. I had the strangest experience when I was in India with Sai Baba. I think I have to tell it now because it was so odd. And to tell you the truth, I don't know whether I passed the test or utterly failed it. Now, all these many years later, I really don't know. If I were to know, I often tell people, well, if you had a knowing, what would it be? If I had a knowing, I would say that I passed it. But given the context in which it occurred, there's still that little doubt in my mind. This is what happened. I was sitting in Sai Baba's little temple back in 1972. I was one of only a handful of Western people there in the ashram. I was staying there for 4 months, and I had extraordinary experiences with Sai Baba. And one of them, I was sitting in the temple, and I was reading the Bible. And I was so into the Bible that I was just, nothing existed but what I was reading in the scriptures. And I don't remember now even what I was reading. But it had my full attention. And I was sitting all alone, I thought, in the little temple. Afterwards, you know, after Sai Baba had come in and we had sung bhajans, there would be a gathering and people would sing the devotional songs. But I was in there early to make sure I'd get a good seat up front. And I was reading the Bible. Afterwards, people said, "What were you doing? Didn't you know? Sai Baba walked back and forth down the aisle, and he bent over, and he looked at you, and you didn't even notice him. You didn't even look up." Interesting, huh? So, what do you do when you don't notice God? Which is what an avatar is. An avatar is as much of an incarnation, undiluted and unpolluted, of God as we human beings could possibly accept without being burned to a crispy critter. So, not sure how well I graded on that particular topic. If it had been anything else, I would have thought, well, you really, you know, were really focused, concentrated. But being that it was God himself, I wonder if sometimes we get lost in the word and we forget to notice the presence that's imminent. I don't know. It's possible I do that, or did that, at least at that time. But just saying, I had another experience, too, I'd like to share. This was shortly after I had gotten to the ashram. And being a scholar and very, very intent on studying whatever it is I'm fascinated about, and I've always been fascinated about knowing God, experiencing God. That's been my passion my whole life. But anyway, I was sitting all alone out in the middle of the sand, because in those days, there was just this big campus of sand with a few scattered flowered trees. The small mandir, it hadn't been all gussied up like it is today with all the ornate golden domes and all of the creatures that are, you know, sculpted into the facade. I was all alone sitting under a flowered tree, and I was reading what I think is Baba's most profound series of discourses, which is called Jnana Vahini, the Stream of Wisdom. And all of a sudden, I knew that I knew that I knew that I was one with Sai Baba. That the Atma that animates and gives him life was the same Atma that animated and animates me and gives me life. And in an instant, Sai Baba flew out of his interview room, which was a few yards away, and came directly to where I was sitting and said, "Acha," which means in Hindi, "good." And he slapped the book, the open book, with his hand and covered it with a manifestation of that sacred ash that they call vibhuti, which he describes as being the ultimate truth of all matter, that everything can be reduced to ash alone. And then he turned just as quickly and went back to his room. So it was like in that moment, I got it. Even though coming to India at that time, I had no knowledge of Indian culture whatsoever, no schooling in Vedas, the Vedas, and was basically an esoteric teacher of the tradition and lineage of Alice Bailey, H.P. Blavatsky, and Helena Rorick, the Agni Yoga teachings. That was my schooling, which is basically theosophical, if you want a one-word definition. So I knew about things, but only in terms of the Western presentation of the ancient wisdom teachings. But in terms of interacting with an avatar, I'd never seen one before. The only one I had read about was Paramahansa Yogananda. So just saying, I was unschooled in this thought system. So reading Jnanavahini, which Jnana is the supreme knowledge that God alone is all that is. It's completely non-dualistic. Dualism is where you believe that God is separate from who you are and is separate from creation. But in Advaita, or pure Jnana, there's the realization that there is one Atma animating every form. And that alone is truth. So anything that changes or has an element of impermanence is simply an overlay of Maya or illusion, according to that highest understanding. So anyway, I wanted to share that as direct experiences that I had. I had another one. Let me tell you this one, too. There were large boulders up behind the ashram, and I used to like to go up there and sit and meditate on the rocks. And I was going through the mood of being a yogi at that point. And I would sit cross-legged on my tiger skin printed blanket. And down below, I could see the ashram. And I could watch the little clutch of people that would gather around that little orange form, little orange-clad form of Sai Baba, with his halo of black afro hair, little tiny form from the distance I could see. And all these vast, timeless hills stretching out way beyond the ashram. Beautiful, beautiful land. And I would be in a mood of supreme detachment. One day, I was sitting up there in my yogi mood, and suddenly I saw Sai Baba floating in the air towards me. I had my eyes wide open, and he was approaching me, floating in the air. And he entered my third eye. I thought I was awake. I thought I was in awake consciousness. But I had a very transcendental experience. I don't remember anything after that. I probably went into mindless samadhi because I don't remember anything after that. But just saying. So let's say I had created a space through whatever that enabled me to have that experience. And probably it was because with all of my being, I was present with the divine. There wasn't any other distraction going on. There was just this intense focus on the divine. So just saying, without an abiding interest in a topic, the mind will wander. And when the mind is not present, neither are you. And when you're not present, God is not present, because God lives in you as you. You're not the mind, but you are the awareness that arises in the mind. You might say the mind is the connection, the connecting bridge between you as an Atma, as a divine spirit, and your physical instrument, which is just that. It's an instrument that you operate. So the mind governs your five senses. For example, you're in a classroom or a seminar, and if the topic is not fully engaging, your mind will wander. And when your mind wanders, you will not hear a word that is being said, even though you have ears and the ability to hear. And again, though you have eyes and can see, unless what you're looking at aligns with your soul imprint or inner calling or karmic field, you will not really see it. So what I was seeing was obviously from the inner light within me, not just the body's eyes. And this brings up the fact that all the experiences drawn in through the five senses of hearing, seeing, smelling, touching, and tasting are experienced inwardly in the mind and interpreted by the brain. So you can't actually draw in and experience something that your reticular activational system, your mind monitor, if you want to call it that, hasn't come into agreement with. You can't see what you don't believe you can see. Now, the old adage, seeing is believing. Believing is seeing. So the body, according to Jesus and A Course in Miracles, is entirely inert and unresponsive without the mind. So it's our thoughts, our mind, that expresses as physical action. It's the thoughts that animate the body, the mind. So what thoughts occupy your mind and cause you to move about in your daily life as you do? I mean, really, take a look at how you spend the hours of each day. Maybe journal your activities for this coming week and see where your life is heading. Ask yourself the hard questions. I feel that my goal in life is to fill in the blank. So, if I continue living just as I am today, with these same thoughts and habits and lifestyle choices, will I be able to accomplish my goal? I say I want to accomplish such and such, but upon observation of what I'm choosing to do each day, it looks like I have another agenda in mind. I mean, be honest with yourself if that's what you notice. And self-deception is common. When we are attempting to live out of another person or person's set of beliefs, values, and expectations, are you living for you, or are you trying to please someone? For example, we may be pursuing a practical course, practical career in business to please our parents. But in our heart of hearts, we're a free spirit that would rather roam the world and have adventures. Same goes for education. You may go to college just to please your parents. But if your heart isn't in it at all, you'd be wise to notice that. And there's no right or wrong in any of this. It's just a matter of being really clear in what you want to do with your life and really honest with yourself. Believe it or not, thinking in this way is really meditation, the right kind of meditation, which is self-awareness. It's answering for yourself the questions, who am I? Why am I here? What's my purpose in life? How do I accomplish it? That's real meditation. My teacher told me years ago, I'd had a really positive and powerful reading by, it was a 5,000-year-old reading done by the sage Bhrigu. And I had the reading in Mumbai. And it was so incredible, you know, I was just blown away. And my teacher asked if he could read it. And I said, sure. And so he read it, and he said, well, he said, I don't see any problem with you fulfilling that at all. He said, that's a shoe-in for you. But he said, you'll move into these states of enlightenment, but you won't be aware of it unless you look. He said, giving an example, I believe I'm sitting in this chair, but if I really want to know I'm sitting in the chair, I'll bend over and look and notice that I am in fact sitting in the chair. That has been such a key for me, because I would not have thought to look. I would have waited until he or someone had given me validation or feedback, but I actually didn't know how to look to validate for myself my own state in which I was living. Moreover, since we're not really given guidelines or reference points in what to look for, we sometimes don't know how to look. And you look simply by looking. What does that look like? Well, it looks like closing your eyes and imagining yourself and your inner gaze in whatever area you want information on. And usually the information comes without any thinking. If you're thinking, you're probably mood-making. You're probably conjuring up some story. But if you simply have an awareness show up in your mind, generally that's true. What I do is I write that down and I date it. And then I keep it on the back burner, let it simmer. And it will either bear itself out by some outer validation, because the universe will align to convey the truth to you as you're ready to know it. So sometimes there's a little patient period of where you just wait for the confirmation to come in. And when my teacher, John Roger, was alive, I was able to actually email him or write him or call him on the phone and ask him. But he would always wait until I knew. And then, of course, he would validate it. Because teachers don't disempower you by giving you the answers. You kind of have to validate yourself and have the self-confidence to say, well, this is my experience. I appreciate any feedback you can give me. And then, you know, you may get it, and that the teacher may be silent. Anyway, since most of the people who listen to these seminars that I do on a regular basis are here to awaken, integrate, and embody divine awareness, and make a meaningful contribution to life, how's that going for you? How are you awakening, integrating, embodying divine awareness? And how are you making a meaningful contribution to life? How's that going for you? Is your present lifestyle in harmony with your calling, your goal, your purpose? Most have karmic elements in their life situation, especially if you're young. Karmic elements are those things in our life over which we seem to have no control, at least in terms of this lifetime. They're things we've brought over as the baggage of the past that we need to deal with. So the best approach is whatever is present in your life right now as part of your karmic lesson plan. Be at peace with it. What you can change, you make every effort to change. What you can't change, you make every effort to work with it in the most loving and positive way possible. Advanced souls, in their final or near to final incarnation, often take on as much unfinished karmic business as they possibly can to finish it all up this time around. Sometimes that last lifetime is a living hell. I know someone told me one time, it's a good thing you're spiritual because you would have never survived your karma. And I had horrific karma for about 40 years. So I found that many star-seeded souls have come here from more advanced planetary worlds and dimensions, whether they've come in as a walk-in or they've been born into the body. They usually pack their karma in that first 40 years or 45 years of their life. And that's because they're still young and have the stamina to work it out. It's practical. I know as a child I had so much illness. And as a young person I had so many surgeries. So my body was certainly not a comfortable place to be in, but I had denied it in so many lifetimes as a yogi, I had to deal with it this time around. I had to constantly be dealing with my body. And it's because you have to accept and love every part of yourself and not despise or try to get away from any of it. You got to love it all, bless it all. Be present and at peace with all of it. So anyway, if you've had a really tough terrain to plow through in your life, that's usually why. And often I've found in working with people that their spiritual mission when they're a star seed doesn't even get started until 45 or 50. And then, bam, suddenly you're off and running. Now, the millennials in their 20s and early 30s have usually little karma. But they're mainly here to figure out the game plan and then to create their unique niche in life. Because the millennials often have to start their own movement, their own business, their own invention, or one of the unique ways in which they manifest their being. And they're more inclined to travel and adventure and creative daring do than to try to fit into the world as it is today. I mean, some of them do, but basically, they're here to live in the new paradigm by participating in creating it. So they come in to create the new forms. Like the young guy that created Facebook, for example. Or the two young gentlemen that created BBS Radio. So, you see, they push the edge and do something new. So again, just notice where you are in your life. And as I like to say, stalk yourself like a puma. Like a puma stalking prey. Get above your life and the timeline of your life. And from the viewpoint of soul, take a look down at your struggling human personality and look at how it's doing. How is it operating? And are you working with your human personality as a unit yet? Have you made friends? And what do you need to adjust, fine-tune, upgrade, shift up to make your life more in harmony with your calling, with your goal? Acquire whatever tools you need to draw forth your highest potentials. And in terms of your spiritual life, it's time to shift gears, to really move beyond the place of duality and human identification. And a key to that highest wisdom is detachment from the things of this world. Attachment doesn't mean avoidance, it doesn't mean despising, it doesn't mean trying to get away from. It means living from a higher awareness that doesn't take the impermanent too much to heart. And once you've gained true detachment, then even the attainment of the highest divine worlds will seem trivial and insignificant to you. It's funny, you lose all spiritual ambition as well. You might even say that if you were given rulership over all the worlds and were made master over all creation, it would mean nothing to you, because you'd have no interest in any of that. So attachment to impermanent, ever-changing states, people, places, and things is what's causing temporary happiness followed by temporary sorrow. For example, who was the husband or wife before marriage? After you get married, you consider them yours. All of a sudden, these people that you didn't even care about before you met them suddenly have become yours. They're your possessions. I mean, look at that. Did you care about him or her before you fell in love? Or should we say, before you fell into the mirage of attachment? Sai Baba always calls marriage mirage. Or sometimes he'll call your husband your band. And the child. What did you know or care about the soul that chose to be born to you before he or she was born? And all of a sudden, the soul is now your child, and attachment is there. Everything born in a form dies. Someone you love dies. And you're thrown into grief. Why? Familiarity and attachment. All die, but you didn't grieve when someone you were not attached to died, did you? What causes this great disparity of sentiment? Attachment. Attachment arises when we allow the mind to project personal possessiveness upon a person or object. And this is not love. It's actually a manifestation of ignorance. And ignorance is actually not being aware of oneself as divine and the divine nature of all things, which, of course, is eternal. Everything that's real has eternal life. Everything that dies or passes away or corrupts or changes is impermanent and therefore essentially unreal. So only awakening to and realizing one's immortal nature as ever full and fulfilled and joyous, only that will end forever the gauntlet of attachment and its twin, aversion. And all pain arises from attachment to the form and ignorance of the spirit indwelling the form. So joy and sorrow are the two chains with which we bind ourselves. And both arise from attachment and aversion. Attachment and aversion arise from the mind and differ according to each person's karma. So karma could even be likened to that bundle of attachments and aversions that have drawn us into this very earthly embodiment. We are here in this earthly embodiment solely because of our attachments and aversions, which have therefore locked us into duality. Duality demands a playing field. And this third dimensional earth is the playing field where one can work out, detach from, and transcend the illusion of duality. So living as if duality were real is actually living in ignorance. No one would want to be considered to be ignorant. Most of us would find that to be very offensive. Yet as long as we are a slave to attachment and aversion, pleasure and pain, appointments and disappointments, we are, by Vedic definition, ignorant. And all ignorance is identifying oneself with the body and the contents of one's mind, rather than the formless being and awareness of your true self, which is the Atma, the spirit. So, some of you may be Jivan Muktas. What's that? That's a liberated soul. That's a soul that is living on earth, but is free. Now, this is something you will need to look at to see if it's true for you. Maybe yours manifests in a different way, and maybe it doesn't. Who's to say? If you're free, you're free. If you're not, you're not. So are you free? You are not a human. You are awareness, ever-expanding divine awareness itself. Now you operate through a human body-mind instrument, only until you fully awaken beyond identifying with it in any way. When you fully awaken, you will join the ranks of the immortals and will no longer be bound to the wheel of karma and rebirth here. You will appear in and out of time-space only if you deem it helpful in assisting others. Often you do that to awaken other people to their divinity. But you have free choice then as to how you will manifest, when you'll manifest, and where. So you're beyond time, operating in the eternal nowness of life. That's why both John Roger and Sai Baba, who have passed out of the physical form, are now being experienced as omnipresent. Everyone I've spoken to has felt that John Roger didn't go anywhere. He's more accessible than ever. And we feel that way with Sai Baba, too. In fact, he said, I've not gone anywhere. I'm everywhere. And that is really true. So as long as the body's there, we have the maya, the illusion that, oh, there's the master. There's the avatar. All of a sudden, you immediately start relating out of the ignorance of duality. Oh, I have to give a letter to Swami. I have to ask him permission to leave. I have to ask his permission to do this or that or whatever. But, you know, back when you're in your homeland, you never think twice about it. You assume he's with you, he's guiding you. Excuse me. So just notice. Just notice all of that. Many of you who listen to me are votaries of John Roger, or devotees of Sai Baba. And those of you that are Christians, born-again Christians, you certainly never doubt that Jesus Christ is with you, do you? I mean, he said, "Lo, I'm with you always. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you." And Sai Baba and John Roger said the same thing. All masters say the same thing. You'll notice that they all have a similar message, and they all have that way of assuring you that they're always with you. And the only way that you could be always with someone is spiritually, because obviously the body has its limitations. So think of yourself as an omnipresent divine being, because that's the truth of who you are and what you are. So it's possible that some of you listening are in that state of a Jivan Mukta now, a free soul, even though living a seemingly ordinary life on earth. Here are some of the ways that you might be experiencing that. You may have a sense of inner peace and freedom from desire that really sets you apart in terms of most of humanity, who are driven by desires, by attachments and aversions and plans and, you know, where they want to be in 5 years, 10 years, or whatever. So you're a free soul if your only reason to get up in the morning is to contribute your loving and your light to all, to everyone, to everything. You're just here to love and radiate. It doesn't mean that you sit idly. You may be very, very busy. You may be a CEO of a enormous business empire, or a financier, or a politician, or a housewife, or a garage mechanic, or it could be anything or anyone and be a free soul. But the one thing is that you truly care for all life, regardless of form, and you quietly live in divine awareness all the time, simply and naturally. You don't have to hang out the shingle that says, "I am ascended master so-and-so." You don't have to go around tooting your own horn. You just quietly live and naturally love, and do the best you can to be helpful. Really helpful wherever you are. But the telling characteristic is that you don't have anything you really desire for your personal self at all. You are satisfied with your life on every level. Doesn't mean it's perfect. You just don't notice any imperfection. You're not longing for a soulmate, because you feel the presence of everyone with you all the time. You live in the communion of saints, where everyone is part of the brother-sisterhood of divine life. You don't long to be beamed up by Ashtar or to leave the world. I mean, where would you go? Wherever you are, there you are. So that up and down, in and out kind of orientation that people have before they fully move into their wholeness falls away. It's not there anymore. You're satisfied with things as they are in your life. Doesn't mean they're ideal, but they're ideal because you have an ideal state from which you are living. You are living inside out. The kingdom of heaven is present in you, through you, and as you. You have a sense of abundance that has nothing to do with the amount of money you have or don't have. If you have a lot of money, you would use it only to assist and contribute to the well-being of others, because you don't have a lot of personal needs. You don't have desires to go out and shop and be ostentatious. Those things just don't even show up on the radar of your attention. So whatever you have in your life or don't have in your life, you're content and at peace with what is present. You love and respect everyone with no exceptions. You see the good and the divine in all people, all places. And know that everyone, regardless of the outer behavior, is within a pure and divine soul, having the exact experiences they've contracted for. And all is well. They totally look beyond the behavior to the being. And they will deal with the behavior appropriately given their position in life. They're not blind to what is. They will do all in their power to ameliorate a situation, to be responsible for it in whatever way is appropriate. But they also recognize that everyone is a soul here having an experience and a lesson learning curriculum that is individually the best one for them, regardless of what it looks like outwardly. So the state of the mind of a Jivan Mukta is very still and serene. The use of the thinking faculty is only to organize the flow of needful activities in the physical plane. Otherwise, they simply operate through direct awareness. So, you're impeccable with handling your 10 acres of personal life, personal responsibility, and your life is in order, financially and in terms of being accountable to society, and your carbon footprint, so to speak. You practice personal ecology and how you move through the environment, so that harmlessness for you means being aware of not interfering in the life of another in any way. You respect everyone's right to be, along with your own. You are totally self-determined and will not allow another to manipulate or control you or your actions in any way. You're very firm in saying yes and no and keeping your word. Or, more importantly, not painting yourself into a corner by promising something that you have no way of assuring. For example, I promise you I'll come to see you next week. You can't promise that because you don't know if you're going to be here next week. So you're careful what you speak into time space, because your word will bind you to that commitment. You're very careful what you do with your speech. But you're also free of concern and preoccupation with your personal self and personal life. And fact, you actually lose interest in any of the personal worries and insecurities that seem to dominate the mood of so many. You are simply living here and now, responding lovingly with gentle courtesy to whatever is asked of you. You may not always be able to accommodate, but you'll always speak obligingly and accommodatingly and graciously. I've noticed that in all great souls, they're gracious, they're kind, and they're usually very gentle. Also, a free soul would have immediate access to whatever you need to know simply by shifting your attention inward. And by doing that, you attune to exactly what you need to know or say, right on the spot as it's needed or evoked, called forth by the person or situation. You have no question that is not answered by this immediate attuned knowing. You are free of emotional ups and downs as you are directed by the clarity of the witnessing awareness. You see, you understand, and you allow it all to be. You let it be without latching on and identifying with any of it. You have absolute self-confidence. You have total self-trust. The self we're speaking of is the Atma, the spirit, the light within you. You live in great gratitude for the gift of existence itself. You revel in existence, savoring the richness of life and all of its nuances. You lose sight of all otherness. For to you, all life is one seamless whole. No here, no there, no sense of separate otherness at all. No longing, no hopes, no wishes. You're just simply breathing out in the bliss of God, with a sense of great wholeness and peace. That's a Jivanmukta. That's a soul that's free within and without. And the only thing that keeps us from being in that state is trying to hang on to things which by nature must change because they're not based on truth. And all that is not based on truth is a temporary state, which when we move into soul transcendence, soul awareness, simply dissolves in our field. And we find we're living free. So that's your real calling, behind every other calling, every other goal, every other purpose is the one that is the divine call. And the divine call, many of us are right now, in this very lifetime, listening to my voice right now, you're being called into that state of freedom. It's something that you simply move into. And many of you will look now tonight and you'll be aware that you're free. Let's take a deep breath and go out chanting Anahi. Deep breath. blessings and grace to all, everywhere. Namaste.